Betty Wright, what is this shirah? I don't know, but I like it. I like it a lot. Residents of the Brazilian city of Caxias were amazed earlier this week when they spotted a breathtaking but bewildering rainbow cloud formation in the sky. Gene Oliveira managed to film the wondrous event, which left witnesses awestruck and racing for their phones to also capture the moment. While imaginative minds may think that it could that the cloud was a UFO in disguise or perhaps the opening of a portal to another world, there is actually a fairly prosaic explanation, for the colorful event. According to the weather experts, the formation is known as an iridescent cloud, and it is created via the refraction of light by water droplets. Again, Greg Bishop, our webmaster, has posted the video in the highlights section of coasttocoastam.com. Check it out. Have you become a Coast Insider yet? If not, why not? As a Coast Insider, you can listen to the show live or on demand with your computer or mobile device. All audio streams are delivered in high-quality, crystal-clear audio. Additionally, you can download past shows, chat with hosts and special guests, and email the show host directly. All that for about 15 cents a day. Sign up at coasttocoastam.com. When we come back, more of my conversation with Donald Zagudis, the author of the Sagan Conspiracy. He writes here, like a book, the NASA conspiracy against Carl Sagan has three parts. A beginning in 1964 when NASA suppressed his work on ancient alienism. A middle from 1964 to 1990 when Sagan was not permitted to openly express his views on ancient alienism. And an ending when he was preparing to defy NASA, break his silence, and take his ancient alien views public. Before he was able to complete his last paper, which was on ancient alienism, Carl Sagan died. We'll pick up on that point when we return right here on Coast to Coast AM. The Sagan Conspiracy, the shocking, never-before-published truth about Carl Sagan's secret research on ancient aliens and NASA's shocking conspiracy to silence the voice of its most famous scientist on what he knew about past alien visitations to Earth. Donald Zagudis is with us. So this is where the conspiracy gets a little darker. And Donald, you believe that Carl Sagan, and we are coming, we should point out, we're coming up now just about a week away from the 20th anniversary of Carl Sagan's death from pneumonia while he was battling cancer. But you believe Carl Sagan may have been assassinated by government operatives. Explain.
Yes, I do, Richard. And I say in my book, I do not have hard evidence, but there's a set of circumstances that lead me to that conclusion. Let's talk about his death, first of all. Carl Sagan, throughout his life, was an enormously healthy man. His favorite sport was basketball, which he played while he was at college, intramural. And he was lean. He kept a vigorous work schedule that others had a hard time keeping up with, full of energy and vitality. And all of a sudden, at the age of 60, he contracts an extremely rare form of cancer called myelodysplasia. And 2 years later, he's dead at the age of 62, a very, very young age. We lost, the world lost one of its great scientists, a man who gave us so much. And, you know, one of the causes for that particular form of cancer, if you go to the American Cancer Society, you can confirm this, is exposure to radioactivity. And it would only take a minuscule amount of a radioactive substance to go ahead and start that cancer in his body. And because a radioactive substance would have an extremely short half-life, by the time he died and by the time there was an autopsy, any trace of that element would be gone. So it's like the perfect way to assassinate. The United States does not only have that capability, Russia has that capability. In fact, there was a Russian spy defector. He defected to England, and he was assassinated with polonium-210, and an investigation traced the source back to Putin. and that was in the news for quite a while, and that was only a few years ago. And
Right,
so
right.
if you look at motive and means, the Pentagon certainly had access to radioactive substance. There's no question about that. But what would be their motive to having Carl Sagan out of the way? What kind of a threat did he pose? And I suggest that he posed a couple of them. One is that by 1990, the Pentagon was preparing to start a secret project to develop interstellar spaceflight capability by the end of the 21st century. If they would have come out publicly with that, Carl Sagan would have been all over it, because the primary reason that NASA gave for rejecting the Stanford paper was that interstellar spaceflight is a physical impossibility, both for aliens and for humans. If the Pentagon or NASA would have come out and said, Carl, by the way, we're going to start working on building an interstellar spacecraft by the end of the 21st century, Carl would have said, wow, that impediment to my Stanford paper is gone. I can talk about ancient alienism, because if humans are talking about going into interstellar space, then ancient aliens or extraterrestrials should have been doing it for thousands, perhaps even millions of years. And also, what would have come out would have been people asking NASA, why, if you're developing interstellar spaceflight capability, why did you suppress NASA's work on ancient alienism? And so those are a couple of reasons why I believe that it was extremely fortuitous for Carl Sagan to die when he did, because shortly after he died, the Pentagon and NASA started working on building an interstellar spacecraft. And there are two websites that I really encourage your listeners to go to, because it's really an eye-opener. One is Icarus Interstellar, and the other one is the 100-Year Starship Project. And both of these present academic papers written by scientists about what they're doing conceptually and physically to develop interstellar spaceflight capability by the end of the 21st century.
If NASA, the Pentagon, considered it a threat for Sagan to speak publicly about his ancient alien theory back in 1996, isn't it equally as dangerous for you to be connecting the dots in 2016?
Richard, I'm 72 years old. If somebody wants to make me a martyr for ancient alienism, bring it on. I have research that I'm bringing out to the public. My publisher's excited about it. My agent's excited about it. The different interviews I've conducted so far are creating real interest in this subject. And I don't really think about that so much. I just want to get my material out. I want the world to know what Carl Sagan believed in his heart and what he was not allowed to put out there in the public. And I feel like I'm doing the public a service by doing this. And I'll just leave it at that.
So now that Carl Sagan has been identified as a believer in ancient alien theory, what is then the likelihood that AA will become mainstream science? Maybe someone like a Stephen Hawking will pick up the ball and run with it.
That's a great question. Right now, I'm kind of between a rock and a hard place. I'm in that gap between mainstream science and conventional ancient alienism. To be perfectly honest, I'm just learning what the ancient alien community is all about, because I've always been on the other side. If you go into my local Barnes & Noble bookstore and you go down the main aisle and go to the information desk, if you want to go to mainstream science, you pull a left. If you want to go into paranormal science, you take a right. My book right now is over to the right, not to the left. I would prefer that it be to the left with mainstream science, along with books by Stephen Hawking, Brian Greene, all the other, people that write books on mainstream science. But it's not. And so hopefully I'd like to think that someday my book will be found over in the mainstream science section. As far as ancient alienism becoming mainstream science, I think it's going to take a few years for that to happen. I believe it will happen because there's more material that is going to be released, and I encourage people out there that maybe have been holding back, legitimate scientists who in their heart believed in ancient alienism, but they have not been comfortable bringing it out for fear of reprisals from NASA or the Pentagon, that hopefully they can come out and start doing that, especially the young ones. I think the young guns at NASA, I think that they're the future of science. And I think now that the radio telescope experiment is a failure, I think that it's time that we try Carl Sagan's approach, and I think it's going to be very productive. I think it'll create a revolution with ancient alien community, and I expect that to happen in short order.
To what extent do you believe NASA is secretly controlled by the Pentagon?
I'm 100% sure, even from the very beginning. Pentagon, which is the name for the shape of the building, but really it's the War Department. The Pentagon was in a race with Russia to get into low space orbits, and there was military implications, tremendous military implications. It was called the space race. NASA was formed around 1960, and Carl Sagan was actually part of the one part of that group of scientists that helped form NASA. And this was supposedly for peaceful scientific research, but it involved outer space. So behind the scenes, the Pentagon had the money. They had the budget. NASA did not have the money. They had a low budget. And so the Pentagon needed NASA's scientists to develop the rocketry, to develop the propulsion systems, to develop the technology to get into outer space so that they could militarize space for military purposes, because they knew that's what the Russians were doing. And so from the very beginning until the very present, the Pentagon has been deeply invested in NASA, primarily through finances and also through leading scientists who are participating with the Pentagon in developing over-the-horizon military technology.
Why is it, or how is it, that this whole idea of anti-interstellar spaceflight, this lie, has lasted so long?
That's a great question. I think that the public has a high regard for scientists and a high regard for NASA. We tend to believe what they say. And so it's kind of like the doctor, or maybe some people, they're priest or whatever, they're the voice of authority. And so when someone comes up with an argument that says, well, you know, to get to another star system, you'd have to come close to the speed of light. You'd have to generate a propulsion system that would require vast amounts of energy to speed up, and then it would require vast amounts of energy to slow down. And it all sounded reasonable. I mean, I listened to it, and I was a believer. I didn't think it was possible. I read the articles, even recent articles that said that it's impossible. And now all of a sudden, it's not impossible. People at NASA are talking openly about interstellar space flight. And so it was a very effective lie, and it lasted for a lot of years. Anti-interstellar space flight was a cornerstone doctrine of NASA for 30 years. And now they've done away with that, and they admit that they're working on that, you know, on that potential.
I've been to Pasadena a few times and interviewed Michael Shermer, who is a, I don't call him a skeptic, I call him a debunker. I mean, he's a hard-boiled, he's a hard nut to crack, that guy. And I'm wondering what Michael Shermer would make of Carl Sagan's paper. What do you think?
Well, Michael and I have exchanged emails, and I talk about that in my book. I hold Michael in high regard. I've read his trilogy of books on skepticism and the scientific method, and I enjoyed them very much. And he also has an extremely high regard for Carl Sagan. In fact, he attributes Carl Sagan to his deconversion from religion and to become a skeptic and a either an atheist or Shermer might consider himself an agnostic, I'm not sure. So I'm waiting for Michael Shermer to respond to this book. I think that he'll probably come down against it, but hopefully he will provide detailed reasons why that are logical and make sense. I would love to debate him in an open forum. I think that material in my book is well documented, and of course the Stanford paper speaks for itself. Why Michael Shermer has lambasted ancient alienism for over the years, and even talking about engaging the best evidence when he has totally failed to even mention one time the Stanford paper or Carl's work, other work in intelligent life in the universe, he would have to explain that. But you raise an interesting point, and I hope at some time in the not-so-distant future that Mr. Shermer and I can be on stage together or in some type of venue where we can exchange ideas.
Aside from Shermer, who else would you like to debate with?
Oh, there's a whole bunch of people that I'd like to talk to. I'd like to talk to Stephen Hawking, of course. He has weighed in on the subject. I would definitely like to talk to Frank Drake because he and Carl were the ones who basically founded SETI and kind of guided it throughout the years. And Carl Sagan is intimately associated with the radio telescope experiment. Of course, in his novel Contact, which was made into a film starring Jodie Foster, he talks about, you know, radio telescopes picking up an extraterrestrial signal, and then it goes on from there that the signal instructed humans how to build a machine that would transport people to far distant planets, kind of a time machine. And so I'd like to talk to Frank Drake. I'd like to talk to some of the leaders in the ancient alien movement about how they're feeling about my book. And are they embracing it? Are they afraid of it? Hopefully they're not afraid of it. Hopefully they'll talk to me about maybe negotiating a way forward so that I don't necessarily have to be a competitor. Although in science, one of the most honored traditions in science is to have competition. And right now I see myself as an ancient alien competitor to, say, the people on the History Channel. They do it their way. I'm doing it Carl Sagan's way. We both have the same objective, to find the smoking gun evidence that'll prove our thesis, which is a common thesis. We both believe that Earth is a visited planet. How we go about, you know, finding the smoking gun, we're using two separate methodologies. So I'd like to talk to them as well.
We're coming up on a break here at the bottom of the hour. On the other side of the floating break, we'll open up the phone lines and take some questions and comments. But let me just ask you this now, and then you can start the conversation, and we'll pick it up on the other side. You're right that Carl Sagan's dream was to lead a NASA-supported search program, Earth-based, that would compete against the Cornell team. If Carl Sagan were alive today, what would that search program look like? If you got his wish.
Very good question. I'll be prepared to talk about that after the break.
Well, okay, we've got about a minute here.
Okay, let me start then. Let me go ahead and start talking. You just cut me off when you need to. He had a singular focus on where to look, and that involved the Sumerian civilization. He considered other possibilities. He was interested in the human genome, that there might be evidence there. He was also interested in the possibility of there being alien artifacts, possibly be either on Earth or on the Moon or some other planets. But the one that he favored most of all involved the Sumerian legends that talked about humanoids or early humans interacting with advanced beings who taught them civilization, the rule of law, agriculture, architecture, the wheel, very important was writing, and so on. And so Carl Sagan thought this was the best place to go, and to not just treat it superficially, which I believe the conventional ancient alien people do, but to drill down as deeply as possible and don't stop drilling to either hit a brick wall or you make a eureka moment, and you discover what many people have said would be the most important discovery in human history.
All right, we will drill down on the other side when we continue our conversation with Donald Zygutis. Here's Them, Van Morrison and Them. Could You, Would You, taking us into the break on Coast to Coast AM. And please say hello on Twitter, at Richard Serrett, at Richard Serrett, S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T, at Richard Serrett. Just a reminder, coming up at the top of the hour, Xavier Hayes, Ancient Giants of the Americas. That was Tom Jones bringing us back with a tune called Raise a Ruckus from a wonderful album, I believe it came out last year, 2015, called The Long Lost Suitcase. What pipes that Welshman. The bizarre spectacle of a shaggy object covered from top to bottom in barnacles has washed up on a beach in Auckland, New Zealand. This bizarre spectacle photographed by local resident Melissa Doubleday, who posted it on the Murrewa and Wamaku Area Community Group Facebook page to ask for second opinions. She's wondering, what is this shaggy object? The image has since gone viral online, with internet users debating over what it could be. The suggestions so far have ranged from a washed-up sea monster to a large piece of driftwood. Webmaster Greg Bishop has posted the story in the news section at coasttocoastam.com, and you can check out the photo there as well and let us know what you think it is. Join Coast to Coast AM's George Norrie for dynamic discussions on paranormal phenomena, conspiracies, and all things unexplained on his television program Beyond Belief. Upcoming episode on Wednesday, December the 14th, fast approaching, The New World Order with Susan Stone. The world we know is becoming increasingly globalized, and for the most part, that is a very good thing. But as we learn from Sean Stone, the threat of the New World Order is still a very real possibility. That's Beyond Belief. If you want to sign up and start watching episodes immediately, just go to beyondbelief.com. Your questions and comments for Donald Zygutis, the author of The Sagan Conspiracy, when Coast to Coast AM continues on the other side. And we are back with Donald Zygutis, author of The Sagan Conspiracy, NASA's untold plot to suppress the people scientists' theory of ancient aliens. Donald, before the break, I was asking you about if Sagan were alive today and his dream to lead a NASA-supported search program, what would it look like? And was there anything you wanted to add? You summed that up quite nicely in the little time that we had. Is there anything more?
Yeah, I think that Carl would have already found the smoking gun, and that the search for extraterrestrial life, the search part would be over with, and we would be dealing with the implications of that discovery. I say that with a lot of confidence, because I believe that Carl Sagan knew early on, out of a lot of different possibilities, which possibility held out the best chance of being successful, and I believe that he stayed with that throughout his career, doing really what amounted to secret research. And knowing his brilliance and knowing his approach, I believe that he would have made that discovery that right now the world's still trying to make.
Care to speculate on the nature of that discovery? We're not talking about some mathematical equation, or are we talking about an artifact?
I think we're talking about a manuscript. Carl Sagan was a very adept historian. He studied ancient history, and he knew it very well, and he focused in on the Sumerians, as we talked about previously, and the Sumerians were a precursor civilization to the Akkadians, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, and then to the Jews. The Jewish people began with Abraham, the Hebrew people, and Ur of the Chaldees, which is one of history's oldest known cities, a very large city. And the smaller city of Eridu, which was only a few miles away from the city of Ur, where Abraham lived, is where the Onassis legend is about, where the people encountered these mysterious beings that taught them the ways of civilization. Carl Sagan was on to all that. And by the way, I have to give ancient alien people credit, because they also have been on this extensively over the years. But Carl drilled down very, very, very deeply into it, and I believe that it took them to the Old Testament. And ancient alien theorists know that the Old Testament is replete with a number of Sumerian legends, including the flood, the creation, and so on. And so I think Carl Sagan was looking at the Old Testament as possibly being a manuscript that might hold the key to discovery of the smoking gun.
All right, let's dive into the phone calls here. Let's go first east of the Rockies, and Brian is in Indianapolis. Hi, Brian. Welcome to Coast AM.
Hey, gentlemen. Good evening.
Hi there.
Hello.
Hey, ancient alien theorists not only suggest, but I believe they concur that Carl Sagan is the grandfather of ancient alienism research. And being a non-believer a long time ago and being married to my wife coming up for now 12 years, she has opened my mind to ancient aliens and extraterrestrials, and so much so that we bought us a telescope. I bought her one for Christmas. I know she's in bed and not listening, but anyway, a nice one so we can search the sky, you know, try to discover for ourselves. But speaking to the artifacts that you were talking about, down through all the ancient civilizations and the more modern civilizations, you know, the proof is there. It's just my question being, why does the Pentagon and why does NASA or our federal government, why don't they want to tell us? What's the harm in letting us know that these ancient aliens exist? This might tweak our interest to explore outer space even more, and would probably be one of the first times I'd ever trusted my federal government with them giving me some kind of classified information. And I take my answer off for the air, and this is a great, great topic. I love it.
All right, Brian, thank you for that. All right,
thank
Donald.
You.
Okay, that's a great great comment, great question from the listener. And I'll refer to a well-known SETI scientist that I've interacted with, Dr. Paul Davies. He is a physicist at the Arizona State University, and he also sits on a couple of SETI boards, and he's written a well-known book called The Eerie Silence about why we haven't made contact with extraterrestrials with radio telescopes. And in that book, he talks about if we were to receive a signal, that it would be very important for the scientists not to release that information until first they decrypted it and they weighed the impact that it might have on human civilization. And then he specifically talks about religions and specifically Christianity. It's almost like Dr. Davies knows something that he's really not willing to talk about, because if there are extraterrestrials, godlike extraterrestrials, it would be a existential threat to virtually all the religions of the world that believe in a deity. If the deity is in fact an extraterrestrial, then that could potentially create social chaos in a lot of different places that would not be very pretty sight, and it could be very disruptive to societies around the globe.
Well, hasn't the Vatican already addressed that when their astronomer had said, you know, if E.T. is real, he's just another one of God's creatures?
Yeah, that's fine. In fact, a number of different religious leaders have talked about, we're okay with E.T. as long as he's out there. If you bring E.T. down here to Earth, or if you dare talk about the unspeakable, that Jesus Christ might have been an E.T., then that is totally off limits. They don't want to go there. It's too controversial. And Carl Sagan believed that it's in controversy where we make our greatest discoveries. And so that is the rub. And that's why, you know, this is such a hot button topic. And that's why my book is such a bombshell. It's caught a lot of people by surprise. And it goes into places where the authorities don't want us to go.
The wild card line, Brenda is in Alamogordo, New Mexico. Good evening, good morning, Brenda.
Thank you so much, folks. I'm really enjoying your show. Donald, got a couple of comments and a question for you.
Sure.
Recently, Obama announced a big push for landing on Mars. And I don't remember Sydney, but there was a guest speaker on Coast to Coast this year, and he was talking about the super space program that Mars is supposedly already inhabited since like the 70s, and in fact, Obama has been there. As we know, technology is more advanced than we are told. We are kept in the dark quite a bit, just like the F-117 stealth and early development. Supposedly, abductions are to populate Mars, whether it be the ET or government movement. And I would love to see Steve Quayle, Linda Moulton Howe, you, and a few other knowledgeable and theorists on a coast-to-coast show in the future for the whole show where you can compare ideas and have questions by the viewers. And so I just want to know what your take is, what you think about Mars being inhabited, and they're saying that, yes, there is water up there, and it's a very inhabitable or quite habitable area to be at.
A secret space program to Mars. What do you say, Donald?
In my book, I talk about two secret Pentagon agencies, DARPA, which is really not so secret. It's the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and the other one, which is more secret, which is called JASON. And these have been treated in length by Annie Jacobson and her book, The Pentagon's Brain. And what they do is they try to stay at least 20 years ahead of where the public is as far as knowledge of space and as far as knowledge of military applications in space. So what your listener brought up, it gets out there. It sounds like a little bit too speculative, but I cannot repute that possibility, because there are things going on within the Pentagon that we are not being told about, and so and that's just a fact. And so what those things are and what they're doing that we don't know about, it could be anybody's guess.
And then we had the rather enigmatic comments by the late Ben Rich of Skunk Works, who said he said this apparently on his deathbed. This is going back, what, maybe 20 years ago. We now have the technology to send E.T. home. That seems to suggest the possibility of interstellar travel that long ago, a quarter century ago.
Right. I focus on Carl Sagan, and Carl Sagan was adamantly against the militarization of space. Early in his career, he was an advisor for the RAND Corporation, and he held top secret clearances. And after his Stanford paper was rejected by NASA, he surrendered his clearances and he became an anti-war activist. And his motto, his life motto, was distrust authority. Carl Sagan knew things that were going on deep within NASA and deep within the Pentagon that he was not allowed to talk about, and he was well aware that throughout his life that there is a kind of a conspiracy of silence among the kingmakers inside the Pentagon.
The wild card line, Mike is in Long Beach, California. Mike, good morning. Hey, Mike, welcome to Coast.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, yeah, Mike, go ahead. You're on. Very okay. Well, thank you.
All right, now, I think I know what Scott killed, all right? I read it in one of his books. He violated a rule. And the rule is the scientific community is under orders never to admit any life exists outside this planet. Germs, anything, doesn't exist. All life is here. He wrote a paper, I read it in one of his books years ago. Remember the big flu epidemic in 1918 that killed like 50 million people? He said that came from space. That disease came from space, and he documented it, showing how different time zones were affected as the Earth spun around, how the germs kept coming down through the atmosphere and killing the people. I think that's the paper where he crossed the line and got himself killed.
What do you think, Donald?
I think that there's no question that Carl Sagan crossed the line. Whether it be that paper or the paper that I suggested or maybe some other things. But Carl Sagan was, in my mind, an extremely courageous man, and I believe that he died a martyr to the cause. And probably over the course of his career, he probably pissed enough people off that there was a whole litany of reasons why they wanted to take him out.
All right, let's go west of the Rockies. Charlie's in Los Angeles. Charlie, you're on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome.
Yes, hi. Actually, first time calling, long time listener.
Oh, thank you. Welcome.
I had kind of like a weird question. I wasn't too sure if maybe you could help me out, or if at least you could give me an idea, maybe Carl Sagan, what his thoughts would be of it. I had recently heard that NASA was going to change, or at least had said the astrological signs were wrong, and we're about to change them. If you had any idea on what this was about or what it entails, I would like to know.
NASA changing the astrological calendar. Would that even be within their purview?
Well, you know, what I have to say about that is that the calendar, how to arrange a proper calendar, has been a subject of controversy going back for millennia, and the calendar has changed from time to time to time. And as we get the ability to make more precise measurements, we have, you know, we come up with new ways to resolve that question. Exactly how do we make the perfect calendar? Of course, we have leap years now that make an adjustment every 4 years. So I really can't address your caller's question with too much specificity, but I think that is a real possibility.
We'll try to squeeze one more in here, and we go to the wild card line again. It's Brian in Seattle, Washington. Brian, welcome to Coast.
Hi, thank you. My question is that if you read Carl Sagan's writings and on the TV show Cosmos, he spoke often of the dangers of science suppressing information. On the show Cosmos, he mentioned that Russian scientist, I can never remember his name, but he had the theory that Venus came out of Jupiter and was responsible for the Great Flood. And he said, although basically that he didn't agree with his ideas, that science tried to suppress this guy's theories, he said that has no place in science. So I was wondering if maybe he was trying to send like a coded message to people that science was being suppressed and that he himself was being suppressed. And I will take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Great question, Brian. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think the scientist he's referring to is, I think his name is Velikovsky, and Carl Sagan was sympathetic to people who had expansive thinking, as long as they came across as serious thinkers. And he felt it was really inappropriate for science, the scientific establishment, to write off anybody who advocated a controversial hypothesis just because it was controversial and just because the scientific establishment wanted to protect their own vested interest.
Donald, thank you so much for hanging out with us for the last 2 hours. I really enjoyed our conversation.
It's been a real trip, Richard. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I thank you for the opportunity to be on your show.
The Sagan Conspiracy, NASA's Untold Plot to Suppress the People's Scientists' Theory of Ancient Aliens. And quickly, how can people get a hold of the book, Donald?
They can pretty much get it anywhere. They can go to Amazon. They can go to Barnes & Noble. It's also available in audio on Kindle and Nook. And so it's widely available. It's being translated into other languages. And so I'm very excited about how the book is being received.
And a website. Leave us with a website, Donald.
The SaganConspiracy.com. That website is still under construction, so be patient. They can also contact me on Facebook or Twitter.
All right. Excellent. Thank you so much again.
Oh, you're welcome.
When we come back, did a race of ancient giants once inhabit the Americas? Do ancient megalithic stoneworks, out-of-place artifacts, DNA mysteries, and strange bones provide proof of their existence? Ancient Giants of the Americas with Xavier Hayes when Coast to Coast AM continues right after this.